I mean, it may be a little bit too early, but then immediately my mind says, no, it's never too early. We need to confront these things, especially from the Islamic perspective. What would be the duty of Muslims in the face of this metaverse now?
Do you think religion really talks too much in that metaverse?
What do you mean?
I mean, does it play a role in that new world?
Well, Islam plays a role everywhere, even in social media, even on the internet.
But the person who is going to pick an imaginary character of their own, would they necessarily need to have a religion?
I think yes.
Yeah, why not? I mean, in that metaverse, I mean, I would try my best to stick to halal food.
Of course. No, not in that case. I mean, imagine they are the people who are going there, maybe they are going to follow more freedoms. They're not going to restrict themselves by borders.
Mm-hmm.
I think that all comes from the thoughts.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever is in your thoughts, it does not take much time to become action.
Mm-hmm.
And if your thoughts are, you know, kind of monitored, they are guided by this metaverse kind of thing, then it's going to be horrifying when it comes to religion, because we again have to see who are the people who are controlling this, who are the people who are behind this, who are monitoring this all the time, who are basically controlling this, and definitely is not in the responsible hands, I guess.
Well, I assume that just like they did with the internet and social media, they will design it in a way that it looks completely free. You're free to do whatever you want on
the
internet.
Yes, exactly.
And then later you'll realize that subtly they've been controlling and manipulating everything. But let's take this.
This looks so many, I don't know, this sounds a little controversial. I don't know. It's still a mystery how coronavirus existed. But then there were so many analysis, there were so many opinions that this was for population stabilization, so that people do not get more and more kids. When you are in this virtual world, I'm like really sorry to talk about this, but when you're going to create, people are free to, you know, go in and create relations, make relations, and at the same time you don't have child as a real. So this is something that is going to control population as well, and that is something like, you know, we need to be scared of.
Yes, there might be some terrifying disadvantages of this.
So that's why I said, like, it again is a user dependent thing, and user will use it on the basis of his thoughts. And this metaverse can change the thoughts
of a
person.
Yes, but the users as a whole, like most of the people nowadays, do not care about many things. They all are going for a more free world. They want to be free. They want to experience everything. That makes it very terrifying.
Yeah, but surely if a Muslim was to enter the metaverse, they would still have a code of guiding principles for them while they're interacting in that world.
Yes, but the appeals are too much.
What do you mean?
I mean, there are so many things that might enchant you. You would be so... You're going to be attracted by many things. Maybe that would take a lot of your time, so you won't have much of time to think.
I think she means to say you need to work more on your nafs then, because you're already controlling it in this world.
Yes, really. How do you control it?
When you have more options, you have more like resources, then it becomes more freedom. It becomes really hard to control your nafs.
Less scary, because in the dunya, let's face it, there's fears which control you. You know, the police might get involved, or, you know, parents might find out, or this or that. But in the metaverse, you're free. You can do whatever
exactly.
you like.
Yes, exactly. That's what I'm saying. There's no one to control you. You're alone and you can do everything you want.
Please send any suggestion, any idea to our email, that is englishradio@irib.ir.
Sister Zaina, what's the first thing you would do if you went into the metaverse?
I'll go for ziyarat.
What about you, Sister Asma?
Well, ziyarat, of course, is a good case. But I will travel the world, maybe. Go to some museums, libraries.
Wow. And you can actually read the books?
Yes, read the books.
Blimey heck.
And if I'm here, I'll definitely see my mom. Wow. Or far away.
Yes, exactly, for those who are far away.
Okay, so are we saying that it's generally positive?
Yes, generally it might be okay to say it's positive.
Well, it's kind of catch of democracy, isn't it? Because if you have a free platform where you're free to do anything and you ask Muslims what would you want to do, one Muslim says they want to go to Ziyarah, the other one says they want to go and read books. But yes. No, if I'm talking from the perspective of some random people out there, you know, I don't want to do all sorts of mischief. This is a world where, you know, I have no responsibilities, there's nothing holding me back. I'd probably want to go and, I don't know, kill some people maybe, you know, and see what it feels like, you know.
That's very dangerous. Yes, that's another part of the story.
But, I mean, it's not that dangerous, is it?
What if people want to be vampires?
Yeah. I mean, that would be fun. Let's go on a killing spree. Nobody's really going to get hurt.
Yes, that would be a bloodshed.
I'm talking from the perspective of a guy, okay? And we love to play internet games, go online, play Call of Duty so we can shoot up our friends and stuff. And at the end of the day, it's all good fun. Nobody's going to really get hurt.
Yes, exactly.
You know, if we're talking about no children being brought into the world and that's a bad thing, at the same time, nobody's really going to die.
Yes.
And there's other things that we could experience which in the real world you wouldn't really do. Like, I would steal, you know, I'd sneak into people's houses and steal their things.
Yes, okay. And a lot more of creative ideas.
Yeah. I mean,
who knows? We should however,
whatever you do is going to have a great impact on your psyche. It's going to have a great impact on your mental health.
Yes.
You feel, I don't know, if you all the time are going to shoot people, kill people, be vampire and all whatever you have been talking about. I think then you're going to, you know, that will somehow affect
your
real life.
Then there will be a breakdown.
Well, they if you look at the case studies to do with shooters in American schools, you know, the school shooters, they found that a lot of them were playing violent video games. And basically it got to a point where they were so addicted, but the game wasn't fun enough anymore. They needed a taste of reality. And that's when they went to school and they just shot everybody up.
That's what I said.
But this is a very, very small, confined group. All right, this is a very small group. And the same games which are played in America are played in Canada, are played in Germany, in France, in the UK. But you don't see that kind of school shootings, at least to that level, taking place. And so what they found is there is something in the psyche of certain nations, certain upbringings, which bring about that kind of
imperialism.
I mean you could put it down to imperialism, which does have an effect on the psyche of people. But there was a really, when I was studying media studies, there was a really interesting case. Would you ever think of Star Wars as something violent? You'll see that, you know, it's about a futuristic kind of sci-fi movie where people play with, or they fight with lightsabers, which are these swords, which are made
out
of...
That level of fiction is
laser.
Too much.
Yeah, okay, but my point was that nobody would think that that is violent. And yet there was a serial killer in America who, before he killed anybody, he would watch his favorite scene from Star Wars, you know? So it's very specific psychopath type of individuals who get affected by that. And if we take that to the metaverse, look, this kind of violence is always going to take place. Theft is always going to take place. You know, other crimes are also always going to take place. You can't really control it, so why not have fun?
Exactly. And it's free. I told you, you can do everything. The decision is by yours. You decide what to do.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Okay, so there's another plus point to the metaverse. There's lots of people who would never be able to experience real things, you know, like the poor people of the world, the oppressed people of the world. You know, they're not going to be able to experience living in a mansion or, you know, going to a fancy restaurant. Maybe through the metaverse they'll be able to experience those things.
Yes, but maybe, just like today. See, we have a lot of facilities right now, but not all people have the opportunity to use them. Because also in that metaverse, there must be a currency. There must be something to buy things for your own, to sell things. Therefore, you need coins. You have to have coins in order to experience all those things that are prepared for you.
And rich people who are rich in the real world.
Again, they're rich. Money talks everywhere.
Wow. Okay. Well, what about oppressed people? You know, they want to experience some sort of revenge.
Well, the oppressed people,
you know,
I think...
mother-in-laws, you know, like they want to go and... They can't do it in real life. They can't kill their mother-in-laws. They'll go to jail.
Yes.
And probably hell.
Well, I think the world doesn't work for the favor of the poor and the oppressed people. That's been a thing since the beginning of the world.
I don't think that oppressed people will be having that opportunity to go into the metaverse because, as the sister mentioned, you need more coins, you need more money to stay more into that world. And we see only poor people, or the majority of the poor people are being oppressed. It's not rich who are being oppressed.
Yes, and they have some more problems to deal with. I don't think they would even think about it.
Yeah, I mean, what, a child who doesn't have clean water to drink.
We still see so many oppressed people around the world who really don't have access to clean water, to clean food.
They would be more oppressed.
Hygiene, they will be like more oppressed. I don't think they'll be having any access to metaverse.
What about people who are so oppressed that... Okay, so we've been talking about Mark Zuckerberg and the creation of the metaverse, which is a virtual reality that people can actually plug themselves into. It's not just about the visual anymore. It's about feeling that world, tasting that world. So we've been discussing about the pros and cons and the possible implications that it has on us as Muslims engaging with the metaverse. And we've been discussing it with Sister Asma and Sister Zainab. Thank you both for being here today and discussing this important topic with me. From myself and from the sisters, we bid you Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again يا الله يا رب العالمين يا رحمن يا رحيم يا ربي let the ummah rise again let us see daylight again once again.
Seventh Imam, Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salatu wasalam, is actually known as Bab al-Hawaij.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام خير الأمور أوسطها.
زيارة of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kazim عليه السلام.
السلام عليك يا مولاي موسى بن جعفر ورحمة الله.
This is Dialogue, a program on the famous conversations of Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome, dear listeners. I'm your host, Mehdi, and we're talking about the dialogues of Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam. Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and Imam Musa al-Kazim was also the seventh divinely appointed Imam from among the household of the Holy Prophet Muhammad. We find in the various books in which Islamic historians and biographers have written extensively that Imam Musa al-Kazim alayhi salam's personality was full of noble qualities such as generosity. And so historians have unanimously agreed that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam was the most generous of the people, and he was the greatest among the people when it came to giving to the needy. It is said that his purses were proverbial, so that the people had said, "We wonder at him to whom Musa's purses come, while he would still complain of poverty." And so, generosity is one of those noble qualities which can be seen clearly in the beautiful personality of Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam. These, dear friends, are his dialogues.
قال الإمام الكاظم عليه السلام وقد سئل عن الكبائر: هل تخرج من الإيمان؟ نعم، وما دون الكبائر. قال رسول الله صلى الله عليه وآله: لا يزني الزاني وهو مؤمن، ولا يسرق السارق وهو مؤمن.
Imam al-Kazim alayhi salam, when asked about the grave sins and whether they expel one from faith, replied, "Yes." And when asked about other than grave sins, stated, "The Prophet stated, an adulterer would never commit adultery whilst still a believer, and a thief would never steal while still a believer."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. So when talking about these beautiful dialogues and these conversations of Imam Musa ibn Ja'far al-Kadhim alayhi salam, we find that there is a very interesting tradition where Imam al-Kadhim, peace be upon him, he warns his Shias against taking part in the government of Harun al-Rashid, and he warns his Shias to not undertake a job within the governmental establishment of Harun al-Rashid, the Abbasid Caliph. So Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam says to Ziyad bin Salama, "O Ziyad, if I was thrown down a tremendous height and cut into pieces, it would be more lovable to me than that I undertook a work for them, the Abbasids, or walked on a carpet of a man from them, the Abbasids." So we find, dear friends, that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam resisted and opposed Harun al-Rashid's government with this kind of intense resistance, because following someone such as Harun al-Rashid would efface justice. It would change the laws of Allah. It would erase the truth. It would give life to falsehood, and it would destroy Islam. It is for this reason that Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam made it forbidden for his Shias to cooperate with Harun al-Rashid, the Abbasid Caliph, and his governmental apparatus. But Imam al-Kadhim excluded those very few people who via their jobs could save the Muslims from oppression and tyranny and could grant the needs of the believers. This
kind of job that could save the Muslims from oppression and tyranny and help to grant the needs of the believers and the safety of the believers was regarded as lawful by Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam, as can be seen in his conversations with Ali bin Yaqtin. So, a beautiful lesson here that we learn from this dialogue of Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam, that we should be very wary of working for a tyrannical and oppressive government to the extent that we can. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of Arab English Radio, the program Dialogue. I'm Attar, the producer of this program, and at this moment I want you to listen to a shorter speech by Sheikh Abbas Mirza about Imam Musa al-Kadhim alayhi salam.
They say that when Imam was taken into prison by Harun Rashid, he was persecuted, and eventually to the extent that there are different narrations that we have, but one of the most famous one in regards to his shahadat was that he was given that poison. When Imam was given that poison, all alone in that prison, and as they say that whenever the Imam suffers, they remember their grandmother, Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha, Imam Hussein Alayhi Salam the same, Imam Radha Alayhi Salam the same, Imam Musa Kazim Alayhi Salam, because Hazrat Fatimatu Zahra Salamullah Alayha is hujjat upon the Imam. She is the point of reference. Imam given that poison and he is suffering, and eventually nobody there to really aid and assist the Imam in this prison all alone. Where is Imam Radha? Where are others, the close ones? And he dies, and when he dies, when he becomes shaheed, the body is covered with the cloth, and two guards were called to really lift the body and to take out of this prison to another chamber. When they wanted to lift the body, they said that it is so heavy. Why is this body so heavy? When they remove the cloth from this body, they saw the Imam in chains. This was the only Imam who was prisoned and who became shaheed in chains. Other Imams were given poison. Other Imams became shaheed by sword or by poison, but other Imams, when they became shaheed, they were not in chains.
Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to visit our website at farstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all. أنت يا بدر المدينة خير خلق الله يا من قد جئت فينا بالهدى والحب دينا أنت يا
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents. For humanity.
Allah.
Sheikh Kazim Ali.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitani lainur rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim wa bihi nasta'in. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi at-tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum. I welcome you all to IRIB English Radio. You're listening to the program for humanity, and our topic is Hollywood conditioning of the subconscious mind and the extermination of the human rights. As a parent, I would love to have the control and the freedom to do tarbiyat of my children, to plan the child upbringing, to plan and develop and upbring my child the way I want so that I can help them lead a successful and a comprehensive life, a life which is focused in dunya and akhirat, a life that is focused upon success in dunya and the success for hereafter. However, the point that we were talking about is that how the Western world uses different technologies like highly advanced camera systems to monitor our children's behavior, to monitor their blinking of the eye, to monitor the dilation of their pupils, to see what keeps them stuck to the TV, what keeps them attached to the TV, what makes them listen, and what is it that will make them ghafil, oblivious of their parents, and obey what is being told to them through the TV. And therefore you will see that these programs that are designed, the animations or the TV series that are designed for children, they use a certain design, the shapes of the characters. You will see that for younger children they have much bigger and rounder shapes and smaller bodies, and for teens they have more sharp looking characters who are focused on strength and fighting. And the colors that are used for children, the combinations, the contrast, the sounds that are used for children, and the messages that are delivered to our children from these various cartoons. A series of cartoons were designed and launched on TV which were focused on upbringing of the child, teaching them to behave in a specific way, teaching them to argue, teaching them to fight with each other, teaching them to misbehave with the parents, teaching them to laugh at others, teaching them to insult and back answer their parents. So if you look at these serials, if you look at these episodes that are designed and focused on children, they have a message in there. While we are focused on delivering and training our children with the Islamic messages, from the messages that Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam has given to us, from the messages that we find in our ahadith, and we tell our children to follow those. On the other hand, our children are focused with a dilemma that they see all these negative messages being targeted to them through the animation series. So now the child is going through a battle within his head that on one hand, my mom tells me to behave good. On one hand, my teacher tells me to behave good. But when I look at TV, I see all the children, all the animation characters who are showing off their strength, beating up others, arguing, insulting, laughing at others, back answering to people. So now what is the right way? Which one is the right way? Which one should I listen to? Is my mom right? Is my teacher right? Or is this guy in my TV who is misbehaving? He is right. Because every time this guy misbehaves, others appreciate and say that you did a great job. And all these are the teens. So now, the child, to have the acceptance among the other children, starts behaving like this character in the animation series instead of behaving the way we tell them.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
So you see how our human rights are being trampled here we mentioned that our human rights are right to live, right to choose, and right to have happiness and freedom for happiness. So now my choice to do tarbiyat of my children is being trampled. The right for my child to live the way he wants is getting trampled. And therefore, this is where we need to understand that this Hollywood technology, this Hollywood methodology is not just for entertainment, not just to make us laugh and enjoy, but in a way they are conditioning our subconscious mind. Let me take you back to the Ivan Pavlov experiment, that how he used the sound and the light to condition the subconscious mind of the dog. That is how all these Hollywood series, all these Hollywood movies, all these animations are conditioning the subconscious mind of our children by using a specific set of colors, a specific set of sounds, a specific set of messages. And these messages are constantly and regularly delivered to our children so that they get fixated in the conscious and the subconscious mind of the children, and these messages become their command center. And therefore, right from 6 months old to 5 years old, all these kids sit and watch all these animation series, Cartoon Network, Nickelodeon, and other stuff, and this is where their brain is being fed with the messages that when these very children grow up, they listen to the Western ideology rather than the Islamic ideology. So tomorrow when you tell your children do infaq, they will find it more difficult to do infaq, whereas Quran says do infaq. And if their teacher or their colleagues tell them to save money and do not give to others, they find it easier to follow that because that is what has been fed to them right from their childhood. And that is the ideology of Adam Smith. That is the ideology of materialism. That is the ideology that is anti-Islamic. And therefore, let's understand that how Hollywood is working on our children, conditioning their subconscious mind and trampling the human rights of our children, where they are losing the freedom to choose and freedom to follow the right religion. Wa sallallahu ala sayyidina Muhammad wa ahli baytihi tayyibin at-tahirin. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad wa ajjil farajahum.
Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, we hope you enjoyed the program For Humanity. If you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
O mountains of Mecca, you were there when the Prophet Muhammad climbed down in despair. Engraved in his heart were the words of his Lord. To all of mankind, this was his call. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. O people, praise only Allah, glorify Allah. Of Mecca, bear witness that I to the oneness of Allah do I testify. For all that He's given me, how can I deny? My purpose in life should be only to cry. La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah. There is no God but Allah. Muhammad is his messenger.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are and wherever you are listening to us.
The keys of life.
The world is a very, very big house. Many people living in many rooms. We must open all the doors up. We must unlock them all today. Throw all the keys away.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
My name is Sheikh Zaid Al-Salami.
A few years ago I started the course of wanting to commentate on a very important book that I believe is something that would be useful for everyone who reads it, and that is the book Mafatih Al-Hayat, written by Ayatollah Al-Uzma Al-Sheikh Jawadi Amuli. Another very important issue that we deal with is deviancy. People who introduce wrong ideologies, people who introduce wrong and bad and haram habits, individuals who might somehow want to infiltrate into the ranks of the believers and introduce something that would not only bring about misconceptions but destabilize a person's faith. These kind of individuals, they need to be dealt with, and dealt with swiftly. Ahlul bid'ah, as they say. Now, we're not talking about bid'ah in the sense of innovation, because that's another topic altogether related to this, of course. But bid'ah, what is bid'ah? What's the Sunni understanding of bid'ah? What's the Salafi understanding of bid'ah? What's the Shi'i understanding of bid'ah? That's another topic. Here we're talking about ahlul bid'ah in the sense of someone, you know, wanting to bring about some kind of innovative idea in the negative sense. Idea as far as in the meaning of ideology, of course. فَوَيْلٌ, the Qur'an says, بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم, فَوَيْلٌ لِلَّذِينَ يَكْتُبُونَ الْكِتَابَ بِأَيْدِيهِمْ. Woe be upon those who write the book with their own hands. ثُمَّ يَقُولُونَ هَذَا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ. And then they say this, they attribute it to God. So they say something and they say, well, you know, this is what religion is, this is my understanding of religion, and this is what God wants from us, for example. It's their understanding, it's their personal opinionated view. In most cases, when it comes to something like this, it is baseless. لِيَشْتَرُوا بِهِ ثَمَنًا قَلِيلًا. For them, in order for them to gain some kind of financial gain, لِيَشْتَرُوا بِهِ ثَمَنًا قَلِيلًا. They're going to get some money out of it. They're going to get some fame out of it, whatever it is. فَوَيْلٌ لَهُمْ مِمَّا كَتَبَتْ أَيْدِيهُمْ وَالْوَيْلٌ لَهُمْ مِمَّا يَكْسُبُونَ. Surah Al-Baqarah, verse number 79. And there are a few other verses that also speak about that.
Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli, the author of the book مفاتيح الحیات, The Keys of Life.
این مفاتیح با دو جلد باشه. چندین سال این حرف گفته میشه.
This book, مفاتیح, ought to be in two volumes.
یه جلدش هی مفاتیح الجنان است. چه فلون نماز قصاب داره فلون روزون است.
One volume, the present volume, مفاتیح الجنان, is on the level of the lofty rewards for praying, fasting, etc.
یه جلدش کم داره و اون اینه که فلون درختکاری اینجور کم ثواب داره. دعا هم داره، ثواب هم داره.
But the book lacks its second volume, which ought to be on subjects like the lofty rewards for planting a tree.
امام اونطوری که اینو گفته بودم گفته دی اون امامی که گفته اگر روزه بگیری ثواب داره، همون امام گفته که اگر درخت بکاری اون ثواب داره.
Imam has mentioned both of these subjects. The very Imam who has stressed out the reward for praying has also highlighted the reward for planting a tree. There are generous amounts of reward for protecting the environment. When growing wheat, take some in your hand and say these prayers. These are what the very Imam has mentioned. We lack this second volume in Islamic world.
when you see the case of Ahlul Bid'ah, Ahlul Reed, dubious individuals, deviant individuals, people who want to go against the mainstream kind of ideology, who you don't even know who, what their origin is, where they came from, what their understanding is, and all of a sudden they want to enter into the Muslim Ummah, they want to enter into your community, and they want to wreak havoc. In this case, it's very important for a person to be vigilant, to be aware, to be cautious, to remember that sweet talkers are always going to captivate some people, but you need to be smarter than that. You need to be more aware. Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says you need to stay away from such individuals. Don't befriend with Ahlul Bid'ah. وَلَا تُجَالِسُوهُمْ. Don't even sit with these people. You know, some people say, well, we just want to hear what's going on. We just want to hear what he or she has to say. No, don't even sit with them. فَتَصِيرُ عِنْدَ النَّاسِ كَوَاحِدٍ مِّنْهُمْ. In the view, in the eyes of all other people, you're going to be one of their supporters. You're going to be one of their followers. قَالَ رَسُولَ اللَّهِ صَلَى اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِ وَالِهِ. Then Imam Sadiq says that the Holy Prophet said, الْمَرْءُ عَلَى دِينِ خَلِيلِهِ وَقَرِينِهِ. That a person is evaluated, is seen as someone who is a follower of the religion of those who they associate with, their friend, their associate, their companion. Al-mar'u ala dini khalilihi wa qarini. And that's why when it does come to someone coming up with a load of mumbo jumbo, someone who, you know, all of a sudden has some kind of weird way of looking at things as far as religion and issues like that is concerned, then Ahlul Ilm need to come out and stand against them.
I invite you to listen to the continuation of the program on IRIB English Radio.
Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he says, إِذَا ظَهَرَتِ الْبِدَعُ. When deviant ideology comes out, when innovative, wrong, false information comes out, as far as belief, issues of religion and belief is concerned, إِذَا ظَهَرَتِ الْبِدَعُ فِي أُمَّتِي, in my ummah, فَلْيُظْهِرِ الْعَالِمُ عِلْمَهُ. Then the alim, the scholar, needs to come out and show his knowledge, and show his knowledge. فَمَنْ لَمْ يَفْعَلْ. And whoever, if you don't do that, فَعَلَيْهِ لَعْنَةُ اللَّهِ. Then the curse of Allah be upon such a person. Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, he then says, فَضْلُ الْعَالِمِ عَلَى الْعَابِدِ سَبْعُونَ دَرَجَةً. The merit or the virtue of an alim over a abid, over a worshipper, is by 70 levels. And in each level, there is a span of up to 70 years, etc., etc. Thalika, the reason why Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi is saying that the alim is always going to be better than the abid is because a shaytan yada'u al-bid'a lil-nas fayubsiruha al-alim fayaziluha. Shaytan places a heretic view, a deviant view, a heretic idea, a deviant idea among people, fayubsiruha al-alim, and the alim picks up on it. Alim says, well, be careful guys, this is dangerous. This guy, he's feeding you poison in honey. والحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين.
Driving past, walking fast to the field of dreams. Hear the children scream.
There was the Keys of Life by Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran, IRIB English Radio.
Every corner represents a different image in my mind.
a momentary emotion, space spent in time, in time.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Two Blue Lines, directed by Tom Hayes. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Guardian and The Telegraph. And beside him, we are also joined by Professor Jonathan Rosenhead from the London School of Economics. He is also vice chair of Free Speech on Israel, a non-Zionist Jewish organization that believes anti-Zionism is not anti-Semitism. Now, filmed over 25 years, Two Blue Lines explores the impact of Israeli settlement on the Palestinians from before the creation of Israel to the present day, and not afraid to explore correlations between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine, what emerges is a picture of a desperate social and political struggle punctuated by violence, segregation, and racism. By primarily featuring the narratives of Israelis whose positions run counter to Israel's official policy, this documentary also provides a portrait of the ongoing conflict not often depicted in the mainstream media.
You cannot come into an area where other people are living, establish a state, confiscate their lands, and expect to live in safety. And that's what happened. They came in, conquered, and confiscated.
In these camps of misery lived the scores of thousands whose native land was for centuries Palestine.
We took land that in the Bible maybe is ours, but it definitely wasn't empty. There are people living here. This is their land.
This is ours, in every sense of the word.
From a distance, this Jewish colony in Palestine looks as romantic as a Dutch picture. Close to, it's different. The guards are Jewish colonists armed with shotguns.
It's immoral what they do with religion, to my mind. And it's not Jewish, it's un-Jewish.
This is the acid test. This is the reality test. All these values that we've held for all these generations.
If people in the U.S. would be treated like this, we would blow up the planet.
There is a way leading from humanity through nationality to bestiality.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary tackles a controversial subject and isn't shy to portray Israel in a negative light, and even interviews Israelis themselves who are against Israel's policies against the Palestinians and their treatment. Mike, if I can start with you, what was your take on this documentary?
I think it's a little bit patchwork and piecemeal, and that's in part because of the way that this film was produced over the course of 25 years. So there is a sense of a director sort of going back to material and just stitching it together where he can. I think it has moments of real power, and as you say, it does have this new perspective on these events. And I think one of the challenges this conflict has presented to filmmakers is to try and find fresh angles, fresh ways into the conflict that aren't just restating the same old positions time and time and again. And this does find two or three new angles into this conflict that I thought were particularly revealing.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of those angles that you mentioned?
Well, I mean, getting Israelis to talk about this conflict, and particularly recruiting very calmly spoken, very sympathetic Israelis who have been given at the very least cause to doubt what their rulers have been doing over the past 50 years in particular, and often are openly critical of official state policy. It is obviously a very, very tricky subject, but here there is a sense of filmmaker really going a little bit deeper and finding out that there are little pockets of room to manoeuvre, room for negotiation.
It is refreshing to see. Indeed.
Yeah, very much so.
Jonathan, if I can turn to you, what was your take on this documentary?
Well, it's very much not a neutral film. It is objective in that it describes quite calmly some very disturbing things. It represents, perhaps not quite proportionally, it represents the views of some of the settlers who are, if you like, the beneficiaries and the perpetrators of many of the wrongs. It does so in order to reveal the inconsistencies in their position and their assumptions, and some of which I think viewers would find it extremely repugnant. But so that when one of the settlers says, "Oh, it's there's violence on both sides. I was shot at once. I mean, I was shot at in my car with a machine gun," and then he's asked later on, "Why do you live with your children in this dangerous area?" He said, "Oh, it only happened to once." Mm. But for Palestinians, it happens every day. Not necessarily being shot at, but they are subjugated, humiliated, prevented from going about their daily life, etc. And that is shown very vividly.
We do indeed get a spectrum of opinion and views on this documentary.
The whole world sees the immorality of our of what we're doing and of what we've been doing since we've been occupying the West Bank for 22 years. For two decades, the world didn't see it because the Palestinians seemed willing to live under Israeli rule. That is, they didn't revolt. The children who grew up in that period, seeing their parents bending their heads under Israeli occupation, said to themselves, "When I grow up, I'm not going to put up with this."
It was really interesting to see that Israeli author age over the course of this documentary. But I just want to address a point he made. Jonathan, he says that the Palestinians seemed willing, or the older generation, to live under Israeli rule. Surely that can't be right.
I was in Israel in 1956 as a visitor. I visited it not at all for the next 40 years. I don't know, I can't say from first hand what it was, but one can imagine the trauma of this total dispossession. 80% of the Palestinians were forced out. Those that were left often had their villages and their homes destroyed. So one can well imagine that it took time to recover from that. Mm-hmm. And I think the younger generation, which grew up under those circumstances, was then more resilient and said, we don't want to live like this for the rest of our lives. Now, of course, the fact is they have had to live like that for the rest of their lives, and it's getting worse.
And definitely in this film you see this resurgence and this uprising, especially among the youth. And Mike, do you have any thoughts on what Jonathan just said and how the portrayal of the resistance is shown?
Yeah, I mean, it's certainly one of the advantages this film has is that it is shot over 25 years. So you do get a sense of not just how long this conflict is going on, but how positions are shifting, how people's perspectives are changing in the course of that quarter century. I do think you get a sense that people are becoming more and more aware that actually for a long time the only way out of this conflict has been death. And I think people are starting to look for avenues, ways out, and to communicate their position in a way that isn't necessarily violent. And all that comes through in the course of the film.
Of course, in the documentary you also see lots of statistics. It's filmed over 25 years, many historical events that happened during that time. And I just want to touch on a few statistics that the documentary raises, particularly about Palestinian children fatalities in comparison to Israeli casualties. And you can see the difference is stark. So according to the documentary, child fatalities between 2000 and 2014 of Israeli children was something like 133, whereas over 1,400 Palestinian kids were killed by the Israeli side. Does this show then that this is indeed an unequal war?
It's not really a war at all, because it's not a war. A war, you have to have two sides. Here you have basically one side, which can punish the other side at will. Now, I think the suicide bombing was both immoral and it was counterproductive for the Palestinians. So I'm not trying to defend that. But it was a relatively short period when it was realized it was actually reinforcing the tendencies to repression of the Israeli state. So that was cancelled, and I think that is completely right. But people in this country pay attention when Israel is attacking Gaza, and quite a lot of people would know that 2,000 people were killed, more than 2,000 were killed in the last assault in 2014. What they don't realize is that this happens on a small but regular scale every day of the week, and that the numbers killed of Palestinians now in excess of 10,000. So that the assaults on Gaza are less than half of the total of deaths, and that is the price of Israel repressing the Palestinians.
And Mike, do you think that this documentary then portrays the conflict as an unequal conflict, and serves as a good introduction to people who are unaware of what is happening?
Yes, certainly, because it is talking to people on the ground, it is talking to people who are caught up in this conflict either on one side or the other. So it shows you the way the travel system has been converted in a particular way, so that Israelis are allowed to travel on certain roads, Palestinians aren't, certain roads are blocked off, walled off. The level of control extends to something like the water supply, and there's a lot of talk in this film about, you know, some people are going without water, other people have enough water to fill a swimming pool.
The settlements have swimming,
yes. Yeah, exactly. And so what you get in the course of the film is a sense of the level of control that's being imposed over every single aspect of life. To see that is very stark.
It is far-reaching and multifaceted.
The minimum service that the municipality have to give to the people is to take the garbage, to collect the garbage. I don't talk about the roads, you can see the road. I don't talk about the lights, I don't talk about school services and water services. Even water, the municipality didn't give them. The municipality said...
No bees at all. There is no bees at all.
This is all done on purpose. Nothing of the occupation happens by chance. No. It happens on purpose. It happens in order to make the Palestinians' life a hell.
We have dehumanized the enemy as we have been dehumanized only a short time ago. We call them Chayadurabilit, a two-legged animal. We are reenacting without being able to control it. We are reenacting what happened to us as if we've never learned anything.
Very powerful words there. Jonathan, I just wanted to get a quick reaction from you for that woman, what she just said, and drawing comparisons between the Holocaust and Israel's treatment of Palestine.
Yes, well, that in Britain, where we're speaking from, has become a big issue, because there's been an attempt to police what you're allowed to say about Israel or Palestine. If you make any such comparison, there will be a whole gang of people on the phone to the papers or the government saying that this is anti-Semitism because you're drawing parallels. But of course we have to draw parallels with those events in history which speak to people. That's our way of making sense of what's happening now. It's not to say that it is the same, it's different, its scale is completely different. The intention is not to annihilate a whole race, but the intention is to demolish a nation, which is slightly different, with all its identifying characteristics, and to steal its land. And one has to be able to make those parallels, just as one makes the parallels with South African apartheid, which is... I think in this documentary, absolutely starkly evident that it's apartheid in Israel.
Mm. And Mike, we were just talking before we went to the clip, actually, about how this documentary portrays how Palestinians are being dehumanized in every aspect of this control system. What other scenes from the film struck out the most to you?
Well, I mean, one of the things this film did was introduce me to a number of the groups who are working within the Middle East to try and resolve this conflict peacefully. So, you know, groups like Blockade Watch and Peace Block, the Women in Black, who are, I think, wives and mothers and daughters who are on the Israeli side, who come out to mourn the losses of all the children killed in the conflict. So there is a sense of people on the ground starting to realise the extent to which this conflict has cost them personally. And, you know, the scenes of mourning are very, very powerful.
And speaking of Israeli settlements, this documentary goes into detail about that and interviews settlers themselves, who we can see are quite vicious in their treatment to the Palestinians. Now, according to reports, around 600,000 Israelis live in over 230 illegal settlements built since the 1967 Israeli occupation.